Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Norm Welsh about his epic journey from having a successful career as commander of an elite anti-drug task force to experiencing opioid addiction and incarceration in federal prison, which led him to author a book on spiritual development and the creation of ChristCenteredHealing.com. We'll be talking about the healing of trauma, and we invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook on Responder Wellness Inc., PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And check out our website at ResponderTV.com. You can find all our past episodes there. We'll be right back to speak with Norm right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW, EMTB.
So we'd like to welcome Norm Welsh to Responder Resilience. Norm, great to see you.
Nice to be here. I'm honored. Thank you.
So I'm sure we have a lot that we can dive deep into. Stacey, why don't you start off the questions?
Sure. Norm, what led to your interest in law enforcement? Why don't we just start there?
Well, my father owned a business, auto repair business, and I just knew it wasn't for me, right? I love cars, but I knew there was something else out there. And one night, I think I was 21 at the time. I went on a police ride-along, and I just loved it. I knew that was for me, and that was what made me change careers.
So you got into that profession, and obviously you went to police academy as a recruit.
Well, at first I became a reserve officer. So okay. I did go to a mini police academy, but because I was still working for my father, and I became a police reserve for a couple of years before I actually took the big dive.
All right. And then when you got into the academy, that, you know, you can look back on and say, this worked and this other stuff didn't work. Like, are there things that you would, you know, if you were going to write a syllabus for police academy, what are some of the things that you would look to do?
Well, you got to remember, this was in 1984. So we had a 4-hour block on stress and wellness. And that was it. Mm-hmm. Everything else was police related stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And what I found out later is that it was never in the police perspective. Hey, you're going to end up, you know, being emotionally wounded, and you're going to have these scars for the rest of your life. And not that they need to advertise that, but I think it's the responsibilities of the department to ensure that there are things in place to protect their officers emotionally.
What are some of the things that we, you know, practically can do on a practical level? What are some of the things that you would recommend?
Well, first thing would be on how to live your life away from police work. In other words, my biggest problem, and I think this is a lot of other officers, I'm not speaking for everybody, but our whole life revolves around police work, right? So you become a police officer, all of a sudden your friends no longer understand you. You know, I'm not gonna speak for everybody again, but my personality changed. You know, you get that us versus them mentality. Mm-hmm. And if any of your friends say maybe smokes marijuana, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, you know, I can't be friends with this guy. Or maybe has a DUI. Oh, you know, this guy's a criminal. I can't be. So we isolate ourselves together and have this tribal mentality. And I think what it does is it's really it's a bad thing for our emotional stability by keeping us in this tribal situation for the rest of the career, 20, 30 years. So that would be one thing, is to always have friends outside, because I believe that they keep you grounded. Mm-hmm. The second is that activities, have hobbies, have things outside of the police work. I mean, the money is so good that so many people, including myself, just dived into overtime and worked six and a half days a week because the money was great. But it's for our emotional development, it's really detrimental to that. So I think those two things are instrumental. The third would be the family, is to really ground with your family, because a lot of times when we're working this overtime, we work 12, 16 hours a day. There's no time for family. You sleep, you eat, you go back to work. So those are just little things. And I wish that the police department would tell, and it, bringing in people like me. I mean, if I would have tried to listen to myself back then, I would have said, who is this guy? Get him out of here. You know, because I don't want to listen to any criminals. You know, I mean, basically they consider me a criminal now. But the people that have fallen and that have made mistakes in their lives and their careers, I think those are the ones to learn from, right? Because I can give you a timeline of where I saw my career slipping, of what I was doing, what was happening to me. And I believe that there are many, many other officers that are close to that line, not on criminality, I'm not saying that, on stress levels and just overwhelming life events happening in their lives and PTSD and these things, that if they heard what I was going through, that maybe if they saw these same things in their life, that maybe they could say, wow, I don't want to be like that guy. Let me stop here and get help. Because you can't ask for help in police work.
So in your police work, what were you exposed to? You know, what kind of traumatic events were you exposed to? And then when did you notice that was really affecting you?
Oh, as I was a reserve officer, my fourth call out was a shotgun suicide to the head. So at that point, I go, wow. And I grew up in a middle-class family, so I never experienced death. I never experienced these things, you know. And it was a shock to my system. And so my dad was ex-military, World War II veteran, and he taught me to grow up, hey, you bury your emotions. You just move forward. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd had friends die that were in motorcycle accidents. And, of course, at 15, 16 years old, I was crying. Hey, I got slapped for crying. You know, this doesn't happen in the house. Men don't cry. Stop it.
Right.
And then the police academy teaches the same thing, right? Even in the reserve academy. Listen, you can't sit there and cry. You got to go to the next call. So then about 9 months later, I went to a plane crash. We have in town, we have this two-story shopping mall. And on the December 23rd, this plane crashed into the roof of the mall, literally 50 yards from where Santa was. And when I responded, there was 14 dead, and I think there was like 35 or 40 wounded. It was a horrible sight, right? And these are things that stay with me. Like if I could see these images still, but I was good at pushing these emotions down, right? I think it's from my dad. And I think that's what made me, I think, a good cop. You know, I made it, you know, 27 years before I did something stupid. So we have to catch these things. And back then there was no, you know, hey, you got to go to a debriefing. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no debriefings. When I went to work full time, there were several SWAT incidents. I worked traffic for 5 years, and the fatal crashes. We have some railroad tracks in town. I took 8 train versus pedestrians, and you can imagine what a train does to a pedestrian. And of course, it's a small area. You have to help the coroner pick up the pieces, and these kind of things, just I didn't realize at the time, but were overwhelming my system, and I had trouble feeling. I isolated myself. I stepped away from all of my friends because I knew they wouldn't understand. How could they understand what I'm going through? And pretty soon it became a jerk. I became a real, I don't want to say a-hole, but I think I was an a-hole, you know, and I blew my first marriage off, you know, because of it. And thank God my kids still stuck with me. But these are the things that we go through. And, you know, on the SWAT team, on traffic. And finally, I got tired of the death, and I wanted to go to narcotics. Mm-hmm. And then narcotics, you know, is great, except for, then you have child abuse, you have child neglect issues, you know, and you see all this stuff. So for me, it was when I left the police department to the state DOJ is when I finally started to realize that, well, something's wrong, because I was acting depressed. I wouldn't get on my days off. I wouldn't get out of bed. And my wife was saying, and this was in, this is going to be 04. My wife's going to say, hey, you've got to talk to somebody. This is, you're changed person. You're not the, because I got remarried again. And she said, this is not the same person I married. You have changed.
Right.
And of course, you know, being the warrior mentality, macho cop, you know, oh no, I got this. Don't worry. I got this, you know, and I would change it around. Well, if you were nicer to me, I wouldn't have to be depressed. You know, we change things. We blame others. And those were a lot of mistakes I made. I had a lot of make it up to do.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
Let's continue on the storyline that we touched on earlier, and that's you had some medical challenges, which involved having to get surgery and then pain management. How did that all start to evolve into the opioid use and the following, whatever followed that?
Well, about 2002 is I got diagnosed with a Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, which is atrophy of the muscles in the extremities. Huh. And that was complicated by peripheral neuropathy, which is the deadening of the nerves in the extremities. So what was happening to me is starting in 2000, I started getting these big blisters on the bottom of my feet. They're actually called ulcers because they're so big. And diabetics get these, but I'm not a diabetic. So it was kind of strange that I got these. But this started a series of surgery after surgery to stop these blisters from coming up. Mm-hmm. I had no feeling in my feet. So there was really no pain management. But the doctors continued to give me Vicodin, you know, everything that you could think of, Oxy, you know, Percocet, everything for pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take those things once in a while for a headache or, you know, for stress or something. But then when I realized that when I was having kind of anxiety attacks, that these would take the edge off them. And then so I started taking a few. And then I noticed, okay, I'm feeling a lot better. And then when I went to work, and if you think about the number of surgeries in 10 years, I was literally only working 4 to 5 months out of the year. And then I was working another maybe couple months on light duty at the desk. And then the rest of the time I was at home rehabilitating. And they see, this is where my department failed. I'm not going to blame them because this is just part of the culture. So I'm not going to accuse anybody of anything, but this is where the departments fail. They see a guy that's off for literally 4 or 5 months out of the year for a few years straight. No one ever came to me and said, "Hey man, how are you doing? You know, what's going on? I mean, can you explain this? What's happening?" I was well respected and I'm proud of that, but this is where the department neglects to take care of its officers, right? They see somebody doing things. And I had a couple officers say that, hey, I saw these changes in you before my arrest. I saw these changes of you, and I knew something was going on. I was like, well, why didn't you say something? You know, but I think it's officers don't want to see that we're really, honestly, we're just people, right? You know, we're supposed to be supermen. We're supposed to be warriors. Supposed to be able to handle everything. People look up to us. But that's just not true. And so that's how the addiction started, right? Is they just kept giving me the pills. And again, I don't want to blame the doctors because it's all my fault. These are all my decisions that I made. And because they have the responsibility of taking care of our pain. But again, that, you know, I mean, you think about it. Okay, this guy's got neuropathy. He has no feeling in his feet. They actually once cut my foot open without any anesthesia at all, right? In the doctor's office, and they kept giving it. And so the more I felt the positive effects, I shouldn't say positive effects because, you know, it was a negative result, but at that time it was a positive effect that I felt good. I didn't feel stressed and overwhelmed.
Right.
I can't believe that I went to work taking pills, dozens a day. But what was happening in my mind was I was having nightmares. I mean, there's just horrific, horrific nightmares that made me almost afraid to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, another officer goes, "Hey, well, why don't you take Ambien?" So I went to the doctor to get Ambien, and Ambien was the best thing. I mean, I would take it. I would get, you know, watch TV for a while, and I'd be so tired that I didn't have time to think about those nightmares. But the nightmares were very vivid. They got more vivid with the Ambien for some reason.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for so then I was taking Ambien during the daytime. You know, these emotions are very, very difficult to deal with on a daily basis if you don't have the correct coping skills. And obviously I didn't, right? I have them now.
Yeah.
And doctors have taught me a lot of different ways to cope with these negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, nobody teaches it. You know, nobody says, hey, you know, if you're starting to get stressed, do this, you know, A, B, or C. And I think that's a failing in the system. But a bigger failing is the way officers treat each other. In other words, way back when there was an officer that started to drink a lot. And we saw, and of course, we're not going to say anything because we don't want to see our own vulnerabilities, right? But pretty soon you're all like, okay, I don't want to work with that guy. So when you go to a call, you go, hey, I'm good. I don't need any help because you know that guy's coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way we feel about people that are weak. So if you're a weak person, in other words, if we see any emotional weakness in you, so you're crying or you're whining and sniveling or whatever, we just do things alone. And it's a career killer. It really is. If I would have gone to EAP and said, hey, I need to talk to a psychologist, they give me a city psychologist, right, or a state psychologist that works for them. You know, doesn't work for me, works for them. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, I put a gun in my mouth last night and I was this close to pulling the trigger. First call would be to the chief. And I think that's got to change. And that's one of the reasons why I was hoping the church could be more involved, because maybe it could be kind of an intermediary where, you know, I mean, under certain conditions, of course, they have to report, but maybe not directly to the chief.
Well, many more police departments are seeking services with chaplains, making sure that there's a chaplain available and letting police officers know that, you know, this chaplain is affiliated with this department. And then there's legislation now, at least in Connecticut, I don't know about California, mandating that we have peer support teams. And also that in the academies, the police and the fire academy, there needs to be more hours devoted to mental health. And I'm hoping that some of that addresses coping skills, because just to start planting the seed that, you know, you're signing up for a career that is going to expose you to trauma, you need to expect that. And these are the symptoms to be, you know, cautious or aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And here are some ways to deal with those symptoms,
right.
You know. Yeah.
You're exactly right. And I would even add in there in the academy to have maybe family come in and maybe have an instructor talk to the family about the difficulties of living as a wife or children of an officer. Mm-hmm. You know, this one time, it's not really pertinent to this conversation, but it is to the family. In the state where I work, we had to fill out all these paperwork about death notifications so that if something happened to me, it would be somebody that we knew that come and notify my wife of the death. And so I was in another part of the state, and my self-service was gone. And so my best friend came and stopped by to visit. And when my wife answered that, she was freaked out. She started just crying, and she fell to the ground, and she thought it was the death notification, you know. So these are things that we don't even think about that our family goes through. Mm-hmm. You know, we were involved in a couple of shootings. It's on the news. All of a sudden, you know, my family's freaking out. So these are things that maybe should be taught, not taught in the academy, but discussed with family in the academy.
And I think that's something that if there is a departmental psychologist, that they can set up a program, you know, maybe a couple times a year where, you know, they invite the maybe the spouses or partners of the police officers and have an agenda of what to talk about, what to expect, what's most helpful in dealing with your police officer partner, you know, and that's probably going to be a department by department decision. That's my understanding for that. I don't know that. I can't see that becoming a part of the academy.
But it'd be fantastic if it's somehow covered at the beginning of the career and then at touch points throughout the career and even into retirement. Because what we're talking about is, you know, someone who's having a long career wanting to come out the other side, not only healthy mentally and physically, but also have an intact family. And social support. So you're not retiring in this kind of like, you know, divorced, isolated, no friends outside of the department situation.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it's to the department's benefit too, because I mean, imagine how much money it costs to hire and train an individual. And then say 10 years in, they leave for stress, or they just say, hey, I can't do this job no more. The money they're losing. So it's to their benefit to make sure the officers are fit. The problem is who can the officers trust to talk to openly? And I think the chaplain thing, I think, is the best thing. And I'm just getting ordained as a chaplain right now. Mm-hmm. I would love to do that. The departments that I kind of inquired in just laughed at me and go, you got your felon. Sorry. You know, but again, to get someone that's been there and done that, I think is invaluable, but yeah.
Let's touch on that part of your story, because we didn't go there yet, but what were some of the choices that led to your conviction and then serving time in federal prison? And then tell us a little bit about that experience in prison and your transformation there.
Well, I thought about this long and hard for a long, long, long time, is where I took the wrong road, right? Mm-hmm. That fork in the road.
Right.
And I truly believe that it was in the mid-2000s. There was my co-defendant, who was an ex-officer and was now a private eye. Mm-hmm. He started asking me for, you know, like, hey, can you please run this plate? You know, can you check for warrants on this guy? You know, and of course that's illegal for us to do, but as a suspect, you know, I thought he was a friend at the time, so I did it. And I think that first ethics violation, I think, is that slippery slope, right? So we got to be really careful. I remember out in our area, oh God, this was 30 years ago, but there was officers that responded to an alarm, and they have them on video taking candy bars and Cokes and stuff like that. These are the little things that really you don't think of anything, you know, free lunches, free dinners, you know, but these are the things I think that begin you to be on that slope. Right. And not that that's what caused me to make the stupid decisions, but that's where I believe I went wrong. And then it was just
getting away with, if you could get away with one thing and not get caught, then you kind of up the intensity of it. Right. Because there's got to be some sort of excitement in that risk taking.
You know, I didn't feel at the time, but later on when I evaluated it, you know, where I was losing adrenaline rush because when I was going through all this with my feet, I couldn't be that guy in the front of the stack, right? In order, when you go do a search warrant, I was always the guy that was towards the front. I had to be towards the back now, because I was more a liability to those guys than anything. Right. So you're exactly right. You don't think about it at the time. But when, after my arrest, I was thinking, wow, you know, I think I was addicted to the adrenaline, you know, so you're exactly right. And then I think also hey, almost like you're deserving, right? Hey, I work hard. They don't pay me enough. You know, I'm going to take this or that. And I don't know. I've never seen anybody really do that. I've never seen it, witnessed anybody steal or anything. But, you know, I could see some of the decision-making of some of the guys was getting to the point of, I don't want to say criminal, but going that wrong direction. You know? So I think that's where it started. But then what happened was the pills. You know, I started making poor decisions. Mm-hmm. I think I was handling things all right. I mean, just all right. I should have retired at the time. And a lot of people will say, hey, why didn't you just retire? Because my feet and then my hands, you know, started curling and I just had surgery on this hand and I can't grab anything. I was having a difficult time manipulating the weapon. I couldn't button my shirts anymore. I couldn't zip so my wife put Velcro in my shirts and everything. So I knew I was going downhill. I knew my career was ending.
Right.
But it's so difficult to admit that loss. I mean, I started doing so many dangerous things. It's a no-no to enter in a search warrant alone, right? You go into a room alone. You always go with two people. I used to go in alone. I used to make traffic stops in the middle of the night from an undercover car alone, almost hoping that I get shot and killed so I wouldn't have to go through everything.
Some people would see that, some therapists would see that as sort of passive suicidal ideation. You know, when you put yourself into a dangerous situation and sort of like, if I get shot, I get shot. Oh, well, because it's on the back of your mind that you're in such despair over your current situation that if I get taken out, then it's over.
Right. But my situation will be better, right? I'll be in a better place. And nobody has to deal with me anymore. And especially when you have guilt from stuff that you did, you know, it's even worse.
Right.
So I did that. I drove, 80 miles an hour on the freeway because I was in an unmarked car. So nobody knew who I was. The plates came back to nothing. I just did some really stupid things. And I never thought really about being wounded and maybe being maimed forever or being a quadriplegic from a shot. I just thought, okay, they're going to shoot and kill me. And that's just the warped mind we have, right? We don't think of that. We just think, I'm going to have this funeral. Thousands of people will come. And it'll be awesome. And then, but now I've got this disease and I'm going to quit. Everybody's going to laugh at me for being weak. And no one's ever going to say hi to me again. You know, I've talked to many retired officers who said, hey, once you're gone, you're gone. And that's really a shame, too. You know, because more retired officers commit suicide than current officers.
Yeah, it's that first year out of retirement is a lethal time for retired cops. And my thought has always been, why can't we, recruit retired police officers or if it's firemen to be part of their peer support team? They've been there. Oh, they've done that. They've seen everything that these younger people are coming up, and it would give them a sense of purpose. And, they could pass their wisdom on. I really think using retirees or giving them that opportunity, I think would be helpful. It's a win-win.
Totally. That's a win-win.
Awesome idea. I love it. I love it.
It's also, using decades of experience and training to continue to have that knowledge in play. And another thought I had also is that, you have leadership development throughout the career where sometimes people need help being coached for promotions. And you've got retired officers who could probably be great mentors and coaches.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's a great idea. But what that just reminded me of is when they sent me to supervisor school, they teach in there to watch over your officers, right? Look for different signs. And again, I don't want to go back to my department because, all the decisions I made were my own. There's no blame anywhere. But I think if you have these yearly evaluations like I did, and all my evaluations were constantly above average. And so I think maybe it would behoove departments to have their supervisors dig a little bit deeper in, right? Instead of just trying to get it done and get them out of your office, sit down, maybe have a cup of coffee with them and say, hey, how's everything going? You know, hey, the other day I saw you kind of yell or lash out. Are you okay? You know, things like that would maybe have worked on me. Maybe I would have said, oh, yeah, I'm just going through a lot of stress right now. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe I would have blown it off. But I think we need to get more involved in our officers' lives, right? I mean, not intricately. I just mean emotionally to figure out if they're really fit for duty, because for years I wasn't fit for duty.
Right. Yeah, it's a great point. And I, you know, found that there could be a lot more training of the officers, the supervisor officers, so they're a little more tuned into when there might be a problem. I certainly know some people under my command were having problems that I wasn't aware of. And it probably, I'm sure there's ways out there we could start to increase awareness of, you know, what's going on, what's some of the things to look out for with mental health issues. And then more importantly is what resources can we bring into play when someone needs that help?
Yeah. Yeah. And stopping the stigma of mental health is imperative, you know.
Our mission at Responder Wellness, Inc. is to subsidize or provide free of charge safety equipment and wellness services to first responders, including police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and 911 operators throughout Connecticut. Resources include scholarships to train new EMTs, a responder and veteran-only AA group in Danbury, Connecticut, as well as police vests, a fire and EMS boot program, yoga classes, gym memberships, and t-shirts. The founder of Responder Wellness, Inc. co-leads a peer support group sponsored by Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Responder Wellness, Inc. is a nonprofit 501c3. Find us on the web at responderwellness.org, on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc., or email us responderwellness@gmail.com. Responder Wellness, Inc., putting responders first.
So anyway, the next step, so I was handling it okay, and the next step was my daughter, who was 24 at the time. I have two girls. She came down with liver tumors, and she was going through a rough time. And she asked me to go to the doctor with her, and what they diagnosed were these tumors, and one was wrapped around this artery. And they said that only UCLA Medical Center could do the surgery, and there was only a 50% survival of this surgery.
Wow.
That was my downward spiral moment. You know, I couldn't handle it. This is my daughter. You know, and what was going through my mind is again, it's such flawed thinking. And this is where we need to stop this thinking. We need to be more grounded. It's because I saw all these issues in myself, not only medical, but mental issues. And I thought that she has my DNA. So I gave this to her. Right.
Oh,
I
mean, that's so your own guilt. Right.
My guilt. I'll just wrap me up here. I'm responsible for my daughter's death, all this other stuff that I'm going through. And it wasn't more than 2 weeks later that I started putting a gun in my mouth. And I couldn't deal with it anymore. It was just too much. You know, I think as humans, we can only deal with so much. If we don't properly cope with these things, life just keeps stacking up, right?
And I think probably the worst piece of, you know, feeling guilt, feeling like you've made mistakes or you've contributed to a bad situation, and you've had the message of you need to be strong, suck it up, and don't talk to anybody about it. Now you're alone with it. And so there's that hopelessness, helplessness that starts to brew. Once that happens, that's when people start to think, I don't want to deal with this anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. And that would be suicidality. And there's such risk in that. And if we can help people get over the, help first responders get over the stigma, that there's no shame in talking to somebody and not being alone. And then sometimes when that happens, when you talk, you bounce your ideas off of someone, you realize how out in left field they are, how far away from center you have gone in your thinking, and that maybe it's a little irrational how far your thinking has gone. Talking to one person that you trust can really rein those thoughts back in, and maybe that person that you're talking to can give you some alternative ways of dealing with it as well. And they don't have to be a therapist. They could be a peer. Right. They could be a friend outside of, if you have friends outside of your department, just having someone else in on kind of the circus of your own mind can be so healing.
Yeah. And I noticed that once you become hopeless, that's it. That's the end.
Right.
And this is where I was never a believer in God or spirituality. I grew up in a Christian home, but after the things that I saw, there was no way that I could believe in a kind, loving God with all this stuff happening. So I just blew religion. I shouldn't say religion. I blew God off and thinking it's not true. So if you don't have spirituality, I'm not going to say God, Christian God, whatever. I'm just going to say spirituality. If you don't have the spirituality, hopelessness can enter that picture really quickly, right? So it was the hopelessness that drove me to the suicide ideation, right? Yeah. So there were those two times that I almost did it, and I believe it was God that stopped me, but whether it was or not, that was when I just lost all I stopped trying to stop doing stupid things, right? So this supposed friend of mine, he just asked for he needed the money. So he said, "Hey, I know you have access to drugs. You know, I need a pound of meth, and I'm gonna sell it." And at that point, right there, it didn't sound way out of whack. It didn't. I mean, I never did anything like that before. I mean, I got commendations, and all of a sudden, I'm thinking, "Hey, this isn't a bad idea. You know, I can get away with it, no problem. And if it's gonna help somebody out, hey, good. You know, it's gonna make me feel better."
You justify it, right? You justify it. I've gotten away with other things, and I'm gonna help someone else. So
this is stupidest thing in the world. And now that I work as addiction counselor, I see that I'm not alone, right? Uh-huh. I see these guys that are really, some of them are decent guys, making some of the stupidest mistakes. I go, whatever thought that you could do something like that? It just seemed good at the time, you know. So that's when I went in. I went into evidence, and I actually stole 5 pounds of meth and 10 pounds of weed out of evidence, and I gave it to this guy. And of course, this first deal was sold to an informant, so I was arrested the next day. So I wasn't, you know, even though I worked 16 years in narcotics, and if I really wanted to, I think I could have a much longer career in drug sales than that. But I was turned out to be a horrible, horrible drug dealer. So I was arrested. And then God started moving in my life, right? I mean, I was depressed. I was down. And I was seriously still thinking about suicide. My wife told them, "Hey, he's suicidal." So I spent about a week in a suicide cell. And I bailed out. I was out on bail for 2 years. I mean, they said I was such a horrific criminal, but I was out on bail for 2 years. And this is where God moved, though. You know, I was at home. I was, woe is me, woe is me. And then this phone call comes from a pastor. And he says, "I got your number from a friend of your father's. I just want to see how you're doing." And I'm thinking this guy's bothering me, right? I think churches are just money-making things. "Hey, you just want my money? Do you want me to tithe and give you some money?" So I was being polite, but I was trying to blow him off at the same time. Uh-huh. "Right. In my church, we have Christian counseling. We could talk about this." Yeah. Okay. I'll think about it. Right. But then he says to me, he goes, "Before I hang up, can I pray for you?" And inside my head, I'm thinking, go ahead, knock yourself out, right? But, you know, I'm polite. I'm polite. Go, yeah, sure. So I didn't know what it was, but he said the sinner's prayer. And at the end, he goes, "Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?" And I didn't know what to say. So I said, "Yeah, sure." And he said, "Okay, well, this is where my church is. You know, if you ever want to change your mind, come." So I hung up, went back and sat on the couch with my wife. And she looks at me and she noticed something, right? She can't even pinpoint what it was, but she goes, "What's wrong?" And I go, "Well, nothing's wrong." She goes, "Well, you there's something different." And so I sat there and thought about it a minute, go, "Well, I kind of feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders. I mean, I don't feel great, but I feel better somehow. This is weird." And she grew up in church, and she just didn't really want to argue with me about it. So she kept her Christianity kind of secret from me. She said, "Well, why don't we just go to church?" So we went to church. It was the weirdest experience because this was still, I still had this cop mentality, right? And if somebody was tattooed up, sleeved up, or tattoos on their faces, you know, the judgment of cops going, whoa, hey, man, you know, yeah. I got to watch this guy. I'm looking at him. I'm making sure he's not armed, you know. But the church was full of these guys. They had short pants on and they had their hats sideways and tattooed up faces, tattooed up arms. But oh my God, they were the most kind, loving people in the world. You know, they hugged me and welcomed us. I don't even think they knew who I was or what I did, but it was a great place. So I kept going, and my daughter had to go through a biopsy. So I told the pastor, I was talking to the pastor, and I was volunteering at the church at that time for something to do during the day. And so one Sunday, a week before the biopsy, the pastor just stops mid-sermon on a Sunday and says, you know, I think God's telling me to vote, or I'm sorry, vote. It's voting day here tomorrow. Pray for Norm's daughter. And so the whole congregation prayed for my daughter on that day. The next week we had that biopsy. We came in and they said, well, we need another scan. So they did another scan. A few hours later, we came back and the doctor says, hey, I don't know what to say, but she's got clean liver tissue. There's no, and he showed me, there was the two scans up. One had the darkened area, which was the tumors, and the other one was clean. And then I got mad. The cop came out of me, you know, I go, do you know what you put me through? And I started yelling. And he had secondary opinions from UCLA and stuff there. And at that point, right, he couldn't explain it. But at that point there, I knew it was God that had healed her. So at that point, I knew there was a true God. And I believed. And that's where my Christianity moved forward from there, you know. Wow. And that's what I began to believe. And then everything changed, you know. I pled guilty to the charges because, of course, I was guilty. Mm-hmm. And they sent me to a county jail for a year. But they put me in a suicide cell. And I don't know if you guys know what a suicide cell is in a jail, but it is the most horrific thing you could go through. I mean, it's just, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy.
Right.
You know, it's just, if you've got mental illness, it's going to make you worse, you know. But on the other hand, they gave you all the pills you wanted, right? So I kind of continued in my addiction a little bit because they gave me pain pills right and left, you know, morning, noon, and night. They gave me the Vicodin and stuff that they just want to shut you up. Right.
Sure. Yeah. And comfortably numb.
Yeah. So I took that time to study the Bible, and it was just weird. There was another cop in the next cell. So they allowed us to go out, you know, to rec together, which was on top of the roof for half hour at 2 o'clock in the morning in the freezing December weather. But anyway, you know, there was cops in there that knew me. Because we did stuff together, and they were kind, and they gave me the newspaper and a piece of pizza here and there. So things weren't all that bad. I studied the Bible. And then they sent me to Fort Worth, Texas, because I got assigned to Texas. And the DOJ promised to keep me in California close to my family, but, of course, they don't care about that. But it wasn't really them. It was God, right? Because I get to Fort Worth, Texas, and I'm mad. I'm just like, gosh, I'm so far away. I don't have the money to have my family visit. But then things just started to move. I met another sheriff there that had got caught up with a girl and drugs. And I went to the chapel. The chapel immediately hired me for a job. Then Tyndale Seminary came in, and they were teaching classes in there. And I thought, okay, I know what you're doing. So I took classes. I got my master's degree in counseling and theology there. What happened is that God sent over a guy. He was LAPD, and he had been shot like six times. He ended up killing a couple people. It was all legitimate stuff, but he ended up getting PTSD and alcohol and drugs. You know, we're talking hard drugs. And he learned from some pastors in San Bernardino County on how to heal from emotional wounds from the Bible. And so he started showing me all these things in the Bible. And it was like, wow, you know, because I was still going to, well, I'm sorry, let me backtrack. When I got arrested, I immediately went to Dr. Joel Fay, who is an expert in police PTSD out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he saved my life. I mean, he really did by teaching me coping skills, right? Because I still was having anxiety attacks and stuff. So when I went to prison, they also assigned me a psychiatrist there, and I was going there for a year. And they helped. I mean, they really did. I'm not putting down secular psychology, but I didn't feel healing, right? It was just like coping. How do we cope with our negative emotions instead of how to heal them? And maybe I just didn't go to the right doctor. I'm not sure. But this other inmate, Ruben Palomares is his name, and he just taught me how to look at the Bible from a different perspective, right? Not just reading the Bible, but feeling the verses and meditating on the verses. And it was about 8 months later that I haven't had a negative emotion from PTSD since then. So it's over 8 years. And that's why I wrote this book. I go, God, if everybody can experience this, this is awesome, you know? And I don't know if it was just me. I don't know if it was mind over matter. I contributed to God. I believe that there is a God, and I believe that he heals under certain circumstances. But even those that don't believe in a God, I mean, these principles are paralleling secular psychology, right? So there's CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. But the Apostle Paul says the same thing. Hey, take every thought captive and compare it to the Bible. So when you have that negative thought, like, hey, maybe it's okay to steal this pound of meth out of evidence, you know, you go back to the Bible where it says, thou shalt not steal, you know? So it just changed my life. It really changed my life. And then when I got under a certain amount of years, under 10 years, because I got a 14-year sentence. When I got under 10 years, they sent me to a minimum security in Lompoc, California, over by Santa Barbara. And they had another seminary there, where I got my doctorate in Christian counseling there. And I got my certificate for addiction counseling there too. And so eventually they sent me up to Sheridan, which is Sheridan, Oregon, to do the drug program that I was supposed to go into because I was next in line. But then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, because of my pre-existing illnesses, they let me out early. So I'm on home confinement right now, actually. And I'm able to work and I'm able to go to church and I'm able to do a few things here and there, but mostly I'm just on home confinement. And it's just God has just been moving in my life. And I could see now how if you had spirituality in your life, okay, I'm going to call him God, but even whatever it is, if it's the native God, if it's the Muslim God, it doesn't matter. If you have someone that you can talk to with, you know, it's so calming. So in prison, it's not the funnest place for a cop. Although God did protect, I think God protected me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But when the stress levels were high, I would just go to a place and talk to him. And if you don't want to talk to God, meditate or just talk it out in your head, because all of a sudden, you know, once you, like you said earlier, once you discuss it with somebody or even internally, it's calming and you can move forward. You don't have to bottle that up and keep it inside.
I just wanted to backtrack a little bit where you talk about your book and tell us the name of the book that you wrote.
It's called Christ-Centered Healing of Trauma with a Secondary Healing of Broken Heart. So I initially wrote it just for cops or first responders, but then I thought about it because guys started opening up to me in prison. And by that time, I started to learn what makes someone do the things that they do, right? And this is another thing that should be maybe taught in the police academy, a little bit about psychology, a little bit about a lot of people experience trauma at a young age. And, yeah, you know, their coping skills were not there like me. And then they start on drugs. And once you get hooked on drugs, it's a never-ending vicious cycle of stealing, of lying, of shame and guilt. The counseling in prison was horrible. When I went to the minimum security, they didn't even talk to me. I asked, I said, hey, I still really would like to have a counselor. No, they didn't do anything. And I saw guys coming in there for a gram of cocaine or a gram of crack cocaine doing 5 years. It's like, it just seems to me more could be done. And I know that I might have been lied to about some of their past, you know, I took it with a grain of salt, but I don't know. I think maybe we need to rethink that about youth offenders that are victimless crimes to maybe some counseling instead of prison. And then the cops too, that if we knew, if I would have known now what I know back then, there would have been more people taken to detox than to take into jail. I would have done that. I know it.
Just so much to talk about, and I want to make sure we cover a little bit more about the book and some of the unique aspects of it, at least from what I could see. And one of them is that you talk about looking at the Bible as a Christian 12-step program, and you also focus a lot on forgiveness as being critical to healing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The Christian 12-step program parallels the AA one because AA is based on Christian, but we go deeper into the Bible with it. The way I like to explain it is, you know, on a car's dashboard, they got these warning lights, right? The light comes on, and you know, oh, wow, something's wrong with the car. Mm-hmm. I see it as our negative emotions that are coming out, like anger, resentment, just, you know, inability to manage small little molehills that are made into mountains.
Right.
This is God's way of telling us that, hey, that you've got to resolve this issue. So what my book does is it explains how to go back to the root cause of anything. So say you were beaten by a parent. First of all, there's the resentment. So even in the 12-step AA, you have dealing with your resentments. But in the Christian step four, resentment is God says in the Bible, if you don't honor your father and mother, things will not go well for you. You know, I mean, it says that. So some parents don't deserve to have that honor and respect. But what we got to do is at least we got to forgive them for what they've done to us, because most of the time they weren't raised up properly. Right. Mm-hmm. If you could track mm-hmm. this back,
right.
You know, you have a child abuse, a father's child abuser. Well, if you go back, grandpa did it to him. So that's mm-hmm. really all he knows.
Right.
And so when we understand that and forgive him for that, you know, it doesn't mean we have to reconcile that relationship, but at least we get that weight off our shoulders of that unforgiveness. And then we get rid of that sin. In other words, confess and repent to God for that. It's like a weight lifted off. You know, I never would have, if you would have said this 12 years ago, I never would have believed. I said, yeah, right. Yeah. But it really works. So what we do is we do like a spiritual cleansing. And a lot of people can't trace down their root cause. So I go into how you go about journaling. I mean, talking, like you said earlier, doctor, talking is the best thing. But a lot of us don't have that outlet to trust
right.
somebody to say,
sure.
you know,
right.
yeah, you know, I'm a male and I was raped by my dad at 5 years old. I mean, right. nobody wants to talk about that. But journaling is the next best thing. I mean, and then when you review it later, you could almost see what your responses were to it. So mm-hmm. I teach that it's not really what happens to us that keeps us oppressed in the pain. It's how we respond. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I'm not saying that a 5-year old has a proper response system, mm-mm. but later on we can look at it, go, okay, you know, this happened. Mm-hmm. I can't change it. I'm going to do what's right and forgive him because he didn't know any better or she didn't know any better. And I'm going to move forward and, mm-hmm. And I take it. And maybe now I can maybe talk to people that have been abused. Maybe I can help them. And that's what the Bible pushes. You know, I think it's step 12 too, is to help others. And so that's what the book is about, how to do like a spiritual cleanse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I think that a lot of the guys that I've talked to and have done this program with, it's helped them a lot. And I guess some people it won't, but it all depends on how much work you put into it. Because if you're not honest with yourself and you don't deal with those root causes, you're not going to be able to move forward.
Right, right. And, you know, I've noticed in clients where if they do have resentment for parents, resentment really weighs heavy on the heart. The only one it really hurts is yourself carrying the resentment, not the perpetrator. It really doesn't bother them. So the idea of, and I actually do like a visualization when the client's ready, yeah. is imagine that hook in your heart is the resentment that's still weighing down your heart. Lift it out and place it on the ground. And walk away from it, because that resentment is not serving you. If anything, it's probably causing more cortisol and higher blood pressure, et cetera, grinding your teeth at night. If you're that angry, you know, and how many people have said to me after that they just feel so much lighter.
Yeah.
You
you're
know?
Exactly right.
So,
and a lot of people don't really understand how the brain works and the heart works. because there's so many things that we do when we're hurt, where we're betrayed and hurt by a loved one. It's like we'll make inner vows to ourselves. Okay, I'm never going to, in a case of maybe a cheating spouse, I'm never going to trust another woman in my life. You know,
right.
I'm never going to get married again because she took half of my income. So I'm never going to get married again. And these are self-fulfilling prophecies. And I've seen so many people that you don't think about it, but it controls everything in your future relationships. And when people implode their own relationships continually, you know you have these inner vows in that just block you from having a good relationship.
Right.
The same's true with judgments. You know, if we judge, all women are gold diggers. You're never going to have a kind, loving relationship unless you get rid of all this stuff. And the Bible talks about judgments and expectancies, you know. So if your dad says, you know, you're no good, you'll never be any good. This is something that hook, like I said, a hook's deep in the heart, right? In your whole life, you're going to say to yourself, hey, I'm just no good. Some job offer is going to come up and it's going to be a great offer. My dad's, you know, I'll never be able to do that. So you don't even take it, right? So we don't understand that there's so many components involved in one root cause, and it affects your whole life, you know? So
it's the limiting belief. The younger you are that you form that limiting belief based on that trauma, the more damage it's going to do throughout your life. And so we, you know, trauma therapists need to go back and find those limiting beliefs. What was the trauma that caused that belief? And then heal that so that it liberates the person so they can be the best person that they can be without any limiting beliefs.
Yeah. And it's simple, but it's not, because the person has to really dig down deep and it really go back to those negative experiences, right? And that's what makes it so hard. And the same with the guys.
Yeah, nobody wants to go back and feel those feelings. But the only way past it is through it. That's how trauma work works.
So I was just going to ask Norm to share about where we can find his book. And the name of the book, his website, and where we can find him on social media.
My website is www.christ-centeredhealing.com. You can buy it at Amazon, Christ-Centered Healing of Trauma. Or you can buy it at the publisher, which is www.christcenteredhealingbook.com.
Great. And you're out there on social media as well, Norm?
Facebook, yes, sir. And if there is any officer that wants to talk, you know, I don't charge or anything. I'm really open to trying to help. And that's the ultimate goal is to help and prevent guys from doing the same dumb mistakes that I did. So if there is anybody, please just email me through the website and we'll talk and hopefully get through this.
Well, Norm, fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your story and the transformation that you've undergone personally and spiritually. I think you have a lot of really valuable information to share with those out there who might be struggling with some of the same things and looking for resources and solutions. So we do very much appreciate your coming on and being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So we'd like to invite everybody to like and subscribe on our YouTube channel. It is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc. We're also on bbsradio.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and our website is respondertv.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.